Accession number 21735, Rule 13.
Bob Shrimpton, Rule 13. Bob, you were mentioning the refit. What specifically new equipment did you have involvement with?
It was updating of equipment mainly, because as you imagine, while equipment is built in a factory, there are the boffins try to improve that particular piece of equipment, and so this was a way of updating the equipment on any ship or any aircraft or in a tank, and so that was the object of the exercise. And also, imagine the number of revolutions those propeller shafts may have taken while playing through all those thousands of miles at sea. And so all those had to be stripped down, bearings inspected, and also certain modifications were done to the ship as well. We had originally six 4-inch turrets either side of the ship, three either side of the ship, twin 4-inch guns, but they took two away and they installed pom-poms, and they installed more Oricon guns. This was mainly because the surface aspect of battle was disappearing, but now would come the advent of air attack. So therefore the feeling was we must find more guns to fire upwards than those that are going forwards. So that's where they decided to reinforce air attack protection. And so all this had to be done, and the place was swarming with dockyard workers, welders, painters, and all sort of thing. And so it was a hive of activity.
You mentioned that you stayed commissioned with the ship from your area. When a ship decommissions, do some of the crew then disappear onto other ships?
Oh, yes. Probably a lot of them would go back to their barracks, RMB Portsmouth, and they would be then distributed to other ships. It depends on the length of time that commission is going to take, or refit is going to take. But invariably, in this case, a majority of the lads came back aboard. So they were kept in barracks in Portsmouth, probably updating their naval skills and on the equipment that they've got to use. But then a big majority came back aboard, because I think the captain and Commander Toswell wanted to maintain their crew of ones that they knew they could rely on as efficient crewmen. But that was also an opportunity to get rid of the square pegs in round holes.
How long did the refit take? Because I take it we're in early 1944 now.
I think it must have been... I can't remember now. It must have been 8-10 weeks. Something like that. It was a long time, I know. It was a long time. We were in dry dock up there in Seychelles. And, yes, it must have been 8 to 10 weeks, I suppose, the refit.
And during that period, where were you staying? Were you staying on board ship?
On board ship, yeah, on board ship.
Did you get much chance for shore leave at all?
Well, try to get ashore every night. But I think I had, just under a week's leave down here at home. Managed to get a travel warrant. And then I managed to get a few weeks here. That's right, a week here, then I had to go back. But, it was quite useful. It was a great break. Getting used to walking on dry land for long periods of time was a bit strange, but...
Was it a case of land sickness?
Well, I suppose so. It was quite an enlightening time. But it was a time you relaxed from the incessant movement of the ship, the incessant changing of watches, and all this, and the alertness, or you could relax. But then you had to key yourself up to go back aboard again, you know.
Was that difficult to do, to almost wind up again?
It's more difficult to wind down, because I remember coming home and I'd go to bed 12 o'clock at night. I'd be waking up at 4. It was that mental habit that you got into. And then at 8 o'clock in the morning, I want to go and have a lay down. And so your body, it was like time lag coming in there, you know. Sort of, and when after years, even after I came out of the Navy, I never slept more than 4 hours. It was strange. It was a very, very strange feeling. I mean, I'd probably sit up about 2 o'clock in the morning reading a book. I'd go to bed. I'd be up at 6. You know, it's just that strange chemical reaction, I suppose, the body gets. I don't know. It's strange.
So what happened after the refit? What happened next? Did you have a working up period with
Then you have a new working up, because you obviously got new crew members aboard, and you probably have one or two new officers. That is why you find out how the crew is going to knit together with some new officers, some new newly made up petty officers and that sort of thing. And that working up period is pretty intense. You're on the go all the time, and you go out on gunnery shoots and that sort of thing, gunnery practice. And it was an intense time, because I think, you see, although we didn't really know what was happening, I think it was the fact that the politicians and the generals had planned this D-Day expedition, and so the thing was, get that ship working up to its peak efficiency as soon as possible. That's how it came about.
Where did you do that working up period?
All around Scapa Flow, along through the Pentland and Perth, out up towards Reykjavik, and all around there. So that was mainly where we did our working up period, steaming and that sort of thing.
Was there evidence of quite a lot of activity of other ships working up at that period as well?
Yeah, I think so. In retrospect, you probably realise now why it was, but at that particular time, we used to say, get a bit crowded round here, you know, and that sort of thing. And now we realise why. I mean, we went into the Clyde for some modification, I can't remember what it was, and we saw all these landing craft everywhere. We always said, what are those? We'd never seen one before. I said, I don't know what they are. And the petty officer said, well, they look like landing craft to me. I said, well, where are they going? Well, you know, wouldn't know. Probably Italy or something. And so it's only afterwards you slot things, the little memories slot together. And then you realise just what was going on, sort of thing, you know.
So do you have any other memories of this period while you were preparing, working up?
No, I think it was just an intense period of working up. Trying to... You see, you had one or two members of your mess deck were new, so you had to get to know them and to fit their characters in with yours, whether you blend together, whether you rely on one another. And so all these little memories are all part and parcel of the working up period. And of course, you're eyeing up the officers. You go up onto the bridge and you see a new officer in it. Wonder what he's going to be like, you know. So you have to assess things very quickly.
So what happened next?
Well, after that, we did realise that something major was going on, because we were taking on large amounts of ammunition, large amounts of fuel, large amounts of stores, large amounts of medical supplies. I can remember that part of it. And certain parts of the equipment were being moved around. And then we sailed out down through the Irish Sea, and it was just the beginning of, end of May, beginning of June. And there was a tremendous amount of activity on land. I think we went in, I forget where we went we went into Plymouth for refuelling. And the number of small boats that were in there, the number of military vehicles on land, and we realised that something must be brewing up for some big event. And then, of course, we were told that we were going to pick up a convoy. We thought, here we go again, another convoy up to Russia. But it wasn't that. We had to pick up this convoy of landing craft and small ships out in the Irish Sea. Well, as you know then, that was about June the 4th when that storm blew up. And we realised there was a lot of things going on. And those army lads sitting in those landing craft, they were having a hell of a time. And so I thought it was a damn good idea. The skipper made the ship circle round this block of landing craft, and I think, if I remember rightly, he sprayed some oil on the water, and that had a tendency to drop the wave down so it only became a swell. It broke up the choppy waves, and it helped to relieve the tension on board those landing craft. I say we kept them out on that. It's a wonder we were never spotted. But then, as you know, the weather lifted, and then I remember to remember the tannoy. We were sitting in the mess tent. The tannoy came on, and it was the captain speaking, and he said, "We are now going to embark on the invasion of the beaches at Normandy." And there was dead silence, and then the padre came on, and he said a few words, had a prayer, and it switched itself off, and everybody thought, "Oh, this is it." And this old leading seaman in the opposite mess, he said, "Well, big time, had a cup of tea then, isn't it? We might not get another one." And so that's when we first heard of the landing at Normandy, and that's a sight that you'll never forget. You'll never forget that sight. We came out through the morning mist, and I think it's a recorded fact, according to Commander Toswell, who was still alive, age 90 odd, at Odium, that the Belfast was the first ship to open fire to signal the launch of the. And we fired on these gun emplacements just outside Arromanches. And then these landing craft went in. And what we did, and what we call a creeping barrage, we kept firing at all the emplacements we could spot on the beachheads. And as the men landed, we raised up the range. So we were firing all the way over their heads. It was like a creeping barrage. And so the men could advance inboard. But there's guns. I mean, I forget how many rounds the Belfast fired. I can't remember how many rounds we carry now. But I know we went back twice to re-ammunition ship at Portsmouth. So we must have fired a few thousand shells in those few opening days.
And how accurate was Belfast gunfire?
How accurate? Well, we've had several signals back. I think they're recorded somewhere. From the army officers, the army spotters, praising the gunnery, because they said it was so accurate. I mean, just before calm, they were held up by a panzer division, and they were in a forest, and they required bombardment. And I think within half an hour, I don't think there were any tanks left. I mean, they had army spotters out, but they would spot close to the target, and you fire a couple of sighting shots, and they would tell you then to shift target or raise the elevation. But the officers of the army did send back recorded messages saying, "Brilliant gunfire, brilliant." So, you know, it's quite a tribute to the gunnery officers and the gun equipment.
And on that morning of June the 6th, what could you see of the
smoke? Oh, gosh, yeah, smoke. But we could see, because it was a beautiful June morning, the sun was absolutely clear as a bell. And so we could see quite a lot of the fall of shot. We could see all the activity of the landing crews going up the beaches. Then, of course, we had boats coming back to the ship with injured aboard. Not only British soldiers, but German soldiers as well. And they were treated. before being put aboard destroyers and taken off out. It was an amazing sight. And the thinking of how they built not only the Marlborough Harbour, but where they put those old ships, those old tankers they brought down from Southampton, and they sunk them in a half circle just outside Arromanches, and so that gave a sheltered spot for supply ships to go in. And it was really brilliant the way they did that. And then there was another amazing boat that was there, was HMS Boxer. It was an old 16-inch gun monitor, they called them. And I think they were originally used up in the Yangtze River or something. And it only had 6-foot draft. And it would sail in as close as possible. And the twin barrel 16-inch guns fire these shells. And the force of the shells going out propelled the boat backwards. And it would come hurtling back. And then it would have to steam up onto the beach again, fire the guns, and back it would come. And the other thing is, that was the first time I ever saw those rocket launchers off of like a landing barge, and these things going off like darts. Incredible. The firepower that day was out of this world.
You say that, what could you see of other vessels?
Oh, quite a lot, because I mean, I think the ocean was just one mass. It was like Hyde Park Corner, I think. They all had to maintain their station, because every ship had to know what station and what target it was facing. You see, that's the important thing. We kept on moving around because these 88mm guns could really pick you off from a long distance, and so we kept a little backwards and forward cruising movement. And the other problem was that later on, after they become established, they had a threat of these human torpedoes from the German Navy coming out of Brest. And if they struck these limpet mines on the side of a ship that was anchored, you'd have had problems. And there was a very, very crude answer to that. And that was for the sea boat to go out with a gunnery officer or a petty officer on board with a box of hand grenades. And they would just sail slowly around the ship. And if they thought anything suspicious, just throw a hand grenade in the water. And we thought, what a wonderful waste of ammunition, you know. But all these little crude ideas for protection.
And on D-Day, what were your duties? What were you actually doing
there? I was in day on submarine detection work to start with, just in case there was anything lurking underneath. And then, of course, I was up on the bridge on lookout duties, because once we got close in, there was no point in having submarine detection work going. So we closed the dome up, and I was on watch on the bridge. And that's why you could see so much.
Did you see much of the Allied Air Forces?
Oh, God, the air was black. I mean, my wife and my mother, he said quite recently, that morning, that the air, you couldn't see. It was just one massive aircraft. And it was the same going over the beaches. And of course, the other thing was all the merchant ships were carrying barrage balloons. So that was an anti-deterrent for any of the German airports that tried to dive bomb us. One or two of them tried it, but that's why we had the extra Oerlikons and pom-poms on board. They really plastered the air.
Did you see any evidence of the German Air Force on D-Day itself?
No, not on D-Day, no. I think they were a bit busy elsewhere, but I think they'd done various diversion air raids and that sort of thing. But I do remember seeing the old Dakotas flying over, towing the Horsa gliders. That was quite a sight to see. But, they're all vivid little cameo pictures that you can remember. But, it was the most historical thing, and I'm very proud to have been part of it. Very proud indeed.
At that time, then, what was your reaction to all... Were you amazed at the amount of Allied air superiority?
I couldn't make out where it's all been hidden. Why didn't anybody notice these sort of things? I mean, I know that my mother used to say that the woods all around here was just one mass of tanks. Where did they come from? And how long had they hidden them there? I mean, surely they say, you know, you must keep silent, don't say anything, no, keep everything quiet. Walls have ears, but surely somebody must have spotted it, and I can never understand why German intelligence never worked out that all this amount of equipment was being stored for some purpose. It was absolutely incredible piece of planning and work. I think it was absolutely marvellous.
And that day, what were your impressions on D-Day? Were the impressions that the Allied forces were doing well?
I think the first initial object was that the men had been pouring ashore all day, and we were now getting in heavy equipment ashore. And then there was a lull after about 3 or 4 days. There was a bit of a lull because nobody was moving forward, and obviously there was a big hold up at Caen. But it was only when they broke out from there that it accelerated itself. And so there was that little bit of worry that we might have to bring all back out again. But no, it's just one of those lulls that you get in the remassing. And of course, you've got to remember, if you advance too fast, your supply equipment can't keep up with you. So, and then the storm broke again and broke up at the Mulberry Harbour. And so that had to be repaired before they could get more supplies aboard.
So in this period after D-Day, throughout June, was Belfast performing the same functions?
More or less. Bombarding where they could, but there were support vessels as well. Small boats would come alongside and we'd help to refuel them. Then, of course, we had to go back to Portsmouth several times for refuelling and re-ammunitioning. That happened twice. And so then, of course, the farther they got inland, then we were became more or less redundant. The next thing, we had to sail back to Portsmouth. And again, it was clean ship, re-ammunition, refuel, and then back up the Scapa Flow. So that's how it went.
When would that have been? Roughly?
That would have been around about July. Yeah.
So for that month, you performed support for the infantry and
that's right,
the land
that's
forces.
Right.
Are there any incidents that come to mind over that period that you were there? Anything that stands out specifically?
I think the most shocking thing was the sinking of HMS Swift, I think it was called. A destroyer that was part of our screen. She was about a mile off. And she'd been caught by a magnetic mine, and it happened just about breakfast time. And I know the order went out, sea boats away, and I went out with number one boat, and the ship was already sinking bow first. And I remember seeing the ship's crew just sort of stepping off. And one chap had a Burberry over his one arm and a suitcase over the other. He just sort of stepped into the water type of thing. And another lad had quite a lot of a part of his body had been caught by a blast. And we took them back to the ship and that through scramble nets to get them aboard. That was not a very pleasant thing. I mean, I forget how many men were lost on it, but that wasn't a very pleasant morning. But and the other thing, I think, was having the young Germans sitting in your mess deck, being fed cups of tea and cigarettes and that sort of thing. Thinking, well, you know, that could have been me. A lot of them had been injured on the beaches and that sort of thing. And they also were saying, big guns, big guns. Boom, boom. And they were really most impressed by the gunnery of the naval forces.
With that, what would happen with the German prison boy? You did mention earlier that they were evacuated from the breaches.
Yeah.
But what's Belfast's function? Is it just purely a support function, a point where they were collected?
Yeah, but don't forget, we had a surgeon commander on board, and we had a fully equipped sick bay, so we could deal with major injuries, whereas a small destroyer would probably only have patch-up equipment sort of thing, but we could carry out major surgery. And so a lot of the major cases came aboard, and then we'd transport them into a landing craft and they'd be taken off to a hospital ship or something like that.
So it seems like Belfast was performing quite a lot of functions.
Oh, yeah, I think so. Of course, being a flagship, she has the command facilities to be able to get other ships to come in and do certain jobs and that sort of thing. And they would structure the running of transporting of prisoners or transporting of injured people, bringing them aboard, operations, what they need for supplies, getting them into a landing craft, taking them to a hospital ship or something like this. So he's got the command structure all the time. Because there was Admiral Burnett was at Arromanches, and then just farther along the coast was Admiral Byron with his cruiser squadron. So he would have another command structure there.
As you say, this went on for a month, and
yeah.
You were doing these various bits and pieces. Gradually, you mentioned that you became redundant.
Yeah.
Was that noticeable that the land forces were moving inland?
Oh, I think so, because you couldn't see any movement on beaches. You saw lorries and supply lorries and tanks going ashore, and they would just disappear off. And you couldn't... Also, there was not the volume of gunfire. And the rattle of small arms, that was way in the distance. So you realise that they'd gone farther inland. And then, of course, you get the reports coming over the radio from the Home Service and all that sort of thing, and they were keeping you up to date because they knew more about it than we did from their forward position. So that's how it gradually disappeared.
And you returned to Scapa Flow.
Then we returned to Scapa Flow.
Was there a reaction to returning back to Scapa Flow after that period?
Yeah. Well, I think it was a strange sort of feeling, because you'd been so highly tensed up coming up to the before the landing and then the actual landing, and now it's like a deflated balloon. You thought, well, what else is there for us to do now? But we were still kept very busy, because they did do a convoy escorting I forget which one it was. One of the aircraft carriers up to Bodie Island to ensure that the Tirpitz never came out again. And we did protection of bombing raids up there.
So what was that? Was that in the summer period?
That was in the summer period. Yeah. And after that, of course, we were then told to. That's when we had the Arctic steam pipe sorted out, and we saw up a jib.
When would that have been, roughly?
End of July, I suppose. Must have been about the end of July. We went down through Malta and down through the Suez Canal, across to Trincomalee, Ceylon, and then down to Shanghai.